Good day to you all. My name is Donato and welcome to the latest podcast of You, Me and Sub 3. And for those of you who don't know, I'm a runner. I took up running late on in life, in my mid-50s actually, and I'm planning on running a Sub 3 marathon this coming April at London. And as part of that and my running journey, so to speak, one of the things I've been looking at, and I've come across an absolutely brilliant book, and I have pleasure that this podcast is an interview with the author of that amazing book. And it's all about recovery, which for me, if you've been following my YouTube channel over the past few years, if you look at YouTube Running Guru Show or Run Guru Run, you can find me there. I often talk about the areas where there's a lot of focus about training and the types of training that we need to do to be the best runners that we can be. But there doesn't seem to be much talk about recovery. So when I came across this book, and I've come across a lot of things, and my gut feel often is I think, that's a bit of pseudoscience area. I don't think that's really true. And the wonderful thing about this book, which is called Good to Go, it's a New York Times bestseller, and the author is Christy Ashwandan. And with her talk, I mean, there's so much amazing reviews about this, saying that Christy is simply one of the best science writers in the world, and Good to Go is a definitive tour through a bewildering jungle of scientific and pseudoscientific claims that compromise a multi-billion dollar recovery industry. So yes, this interview that I have with Christy coming up is simply the best. She's a New York Times bestseller. It's an absolute pleasure to have her on the show. So let's crack on with that interview. Enjoy, guys. Hello, one and all, and welcome to our latest podcast, where on this podcast we have a very special guest with us, who's New York Times best-selling author of the book Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. And it's a topic very close to my heart, and it's the book Good to Go, which is How to Eat, Sleep and Rest Like a Champion. And welcome to our guest, Christy Ashwandan. Hello there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's an absolute honor, privilege to have you on the show. So when I first got hold of the book, I couldn't put it down. It was something, the way it's written, I just love it. And as we were chatting before, in terms of my background, I tend to go a lot on gut feel. So I never really had the science. So when I got hold of this book, and you're the scientist behind all this and have proven the research, it's absolutely brilliant. And I love it. And I think it's brilliant. And I just wanted to go through some of the things in terms of the book. How did it come about for you, Christy? What compelled you to write this book? Is it something that you brought together over a number of years, or you've been wanting to put together? How did it come about?
So I guess the short long answer is that I've been an athlete most of my life, and these days I'm just recreational athlete. I exercise for fun. I'm not really training for anything, but I spent quite a few years as a professional cross country ski racer. I was a bike racer, pretty serious for a while. In college, I was a runner. I've been a lifelong runner. That's something that I continue to do, and I still jump into races here and there as well. But when I look back on my serious elite career, what I realize is that recovery was sort of the one thing I never really mastered. And it was, when I look back on my performances, it was sort of my Achilles heel. It was the thing that really limited my ability to perform at my best. And so I think a lot of us have this idea that more is always better. And, if you want to perform better, you should train more, that there's sort of no limit to this. But of course, it turns out that that's not true. And you can actually only benefit from training that you're recovering from. And so this is an important concept. And I did eventually learn this throughout my career. And I think part of the reason it took me a while is that it turns out that I'm someone who performs well on relatively low levels of training compared to other people. So I was looking around and everyone is training twice as much as me. And I thought, well, I'm doing something wrong. But if I tried to keep up with them, I would become overtrained very easily. And so it took me, you know, multiple seasons of, you know, ending early because of overtraining syndrome that I realized, okay, I need to like stop worrying about everyone else and just pay attention to myself and to my own body and what it's doing. So this was sort of the background of my interest in recovery. But the other thing that has happened is sort of in the 10 years or so since I stopped competing seriously, there's something that sort of happened in the industry, and that is that recovery has become this target of a lot of marketing and promotion. And now there are all sorts of products and services that really weren't a thing, you know, 20 years ago. I'm talking about, you know, these, they sort of look like drills or something, the massagers that kind of pound you in the, in the leg,
all sorts of things out there.
The things I like to call them, the squeezy pants, you know, the pneumatic compression boots. Cryotherapy is kind of this new thing now that people are really into. All of these things, infrared saunas. And what I, you know, looking at this stuff, and, you know, as a science journalist and someone who writes about sports science and physical activity, I get, you know, a lot of press releases and companies, you know, trying to sell me on these products and to write about them. And I thought, you know, I'm really curious to see if any of this stuff works. And so in the course of reporting my book, I actually interviewed more than 250 people. This is everyone from coaches to elite athletes, non-elite athletes, a lot of researchers, sports scientists, sports performance folks. I also read probably close to 1,000 scientific articles, you know, looking at what the research shows. So I really went wide and deep. But then the last part that I did was I actually went out and tried a lot of this stuff. Most of it, in fact. Although if I tried every single thing, I would still be out there working on this. Yeah, right. Oh, yes. So chapter one is all about fear and recovery. That was probably the most fun that I had in the study. But yeah, so I wanted to also see what it was like to try these things. Because one of the things that I actually discovered was that some of the things that are, you know, marketed with very unscientific stories and with sort of pseudoscience, in fact, can be helpful for recovery, but they're helpful for recovery because they help people relax and unwind and sort of take a break. And, you know, at its most basic level, that's what recovery is. It's really giving your body the resources and the downtime it needs to repair itself and to replenish, you know, the glycogen stores in your muscles. Yeah, yeah. You know, all of these things, but to do that, it needs a rest. And so anything that helps you rest, and frankly, anything that helps you take some time out of your day away from all of these stressful activities and distractions that we all have right now, is going to be helpful for recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, just rest and relax is right. Good for recovery.
Right. It really is that simple.
It's not magic. It's right. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, when I was talking about the book, just the introduction, you got me at the introduction, you know, because it was a 5K race that you said you had and you won it. And it reminded me of a Santa run where I turned up. We all had to dress as Santas. And I won a $30 prize for pizzas at the local pizza place.
Oh, nice.
And, but everybody turned up. It was a Saturday morning. I think everybody was drunk. Whereas obviously, because yours was a beer race. So it got me from that. You say it's your favorite topic, beer, and your first chapter, beer for recovery. You know, talk us through, obviously you partook in that. But the thing that sort of stood out is your conclusions, you know, talk us through in terms of what you'd done and the conclusions or non-conclusions that really came out from that.
Yeah. So I guess I sort of set about to answer this burning question that a lot of us have, which is, you know, is beer the ideal recovery drink, right?
We don't
it's become very, right? Wouldn't that be great? It's become very common now that, at races, there may be a beer tent. And I know, I've been running for most of my life. And, since I've been of age, I've been in multiple running clubs where we get together on weeknights. Often they're called happy hour runs. Get together after work, go for a run, and then afterwards you have a cold beer and it's really refreshing and enjoyable. But I think there's always sort of this burning question that people have, which is, am I wrecking my recovery by doing this? And I feel like beer is a little bit like coffee and that it's really sort of pleasurable and nice. And so we have this sort of sneaking suspicion that if it's this enjoyable and pleasurable, it must be bad for us, right? And so, and alcohol in general, I mean, we know that, certainly to excess can be dangerous. in moderate doses can be quite enjoyable. And so the question is not just where does that, you know, the difference between those lie, but is alcohol at moderate levels going to be detrimental to training and to recovery and all this? And so I thought, well, okay, I looked into the scientific literature, and at that point there was not a lot of research on this. And I wasn't really satisfied that any of the studies I was finding were really answering the question that I had, which is really specifically about beer after running. Most of the studies I was finding were looking at rugby players who were taking like 7 or 8 or 10 beers after a game. And I thought, oh my God, like I could, yeah. I would be, yeah, yeah. You know, my runner friends, but none of us do that. You know, it's just
is that rugby scenario. Players as in the oval shaped ball? Yeah. Rugby.
Yes.
Same term. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just so we got, yeah. Obviously football and soccer, and so is rugby. Okay, yeah, they
rugby
do like their beer.
Rugby.
I mean, I went to university in Wales, and we were the university champions. And let's just say the guys, this is back in the 80s now. They drank like fish, and it's very different now.
So I decided, I wasn't seeing a satisfying answer, and by satisfying, I mean I wasn't finding a study that really looked at the scenario I was interested in. So I got together some researchers and we designed our own study. And the reason that I began the book with this study and with this question is that what happened is really an illustration of the scientific process and why it's so hard to come up with, you know, really definitive answers on some of these things, because the human body is very complex. Human physiology is not a simple thing to study. And so we wanted to study this. And so we brought people into the lab. We had them run at a pretty hard pace, and then stay.
Hello?
How was that doing?
Yeah.
Did you lose me?
I think it was just a little blimp there. If you wanted to repeat the last 20 seconds, go for it.
Sure. So, we wanted to find out how beer would affect recovery. So we brought people into the lab. We had them run pretty hard on a treadmill. Afterwards, they drank some beer, which we had titrated to make sure everyone was getting to sort of the same amount of alcohol. I can just tell you that for me, that was one beer. And this was a nice amber beer. So not the really low alcohol beer, but not a really hearty IPA either. Yeah. So this is the kind of scenario that's more realistic. It's one beer. A few of the guys had almost two, I think. But this wasn't 3 or 4 or 5 beers. This was just the enjoyable post-workout beer. And so the next morning people came in and we had them do a run to exhaustion, which is basically you're running on a treadmill at a pretty hard pace. This was 80% of our VO2 max. We had to keep doing that as long as we could. And that was the measure that we chose. And so we did this and everyone did this twice. We also had a placebo arm. And so there was only one person in the study who knew who was getting which beer at which time. Although a lot of us runners were pretty easily able to tell.
You all know which one's a non-alcoholic
placebo
beer.
Yeah, the non-alcoholic beer, the only redeeming factor was that it looked very similar to our actual beer, so you couldn't tell when it was in the cup. Anyway, I'll just fast forward to the ending, which was what, when we looked at our results, it looked as though women actually performed better after drinking beer, that our recovery was better and our performance the next day was better. And men, on the other hand, performed sort of worse by the same amount. So the differences we found were on the order of 20%, which is pretty significant. You know, if I knew that I could do something that would make me perform 20% better, or you know, if it was going to make me perform 20% worse, I might pay attention. Mm-hmm. So this might seem like a really great result that we had, something really important. The problem, though, was that I really didn't believe it. And the reason I didn't believe it is, as a participant in the study, and keep in mind, I had been one of the designers of the study, too. So we're designing the study, I didn't think there was anything wrong. But what I can tell you as a participant is that this test that we had of recovery, which was this run to exhaustion, was a pretty lousy test of the thing that we really cared about. The thing that we really cared about is, how am I going to feel? How fast am I going to be able to run? What ended up happening is, we basically are on this treadmill. You're getting kind of bored. It's hard. And it becomes this sort of mental game. Am I going to stop or am I not? How motivated am I to stay here, continue doing this? How long do I want to tolerate this discomfort? In an ideal world, in a study like this, everyone would be really motivated and they'd want to do their best. Yeah. But in reality, life gets in the way. So one of the guys in the study had his daughter there one of the times, and she was really antsy to go. And so talking to him later, he said, I probably quit a little bit early because I could see she was you know, getting upset and I needed to go. Yeah. And there were all of these things. And so anyway, the point here is that it turns out that the answer that you get in a study is very dependent on the way that you ask the question and the way that you design the study. Yeah. And so although our study came up with this answer, the other problem here, of course, is that it was extremely small. We had only 10 people in the study, 5 men and 5 women. And what that meant is that it really was not something that we could take to be representative of everyone else, right? We were really only looking at this specific circumstance, and our numbers were so small that it would have been very easy for little things to skew the results. And in fact, that's what had happened here. That when I sort of looked at other studies in this field and other studies of other products and things, so many of them had very similar shortcomings in this. Yeah. And so often, like I said, the answer that you're getting is going to depend on the measures that you're using and the way that you ask the question. So the first problem that you run into when you're doing a study is, how are you going to measure this thing that you're doing? So if you're saying, okay, we have this product that's going to improve recovery, great, but how do you measure that? How do you know that's the case? So this gets really tricky. The other really interesting thing, and I found this across studies, is that for so many of these recovery products, it's almost impossible to have a placebo and to have a placebo arm. And that's something we found in our beer study. You know, no one was really fooled by the placebo beer. This is also true of things like icing or even something like massage. And so what ends up happening is, if you know that you're getting the thing, this really creates this expectation. This is the reason.
Yeah.
I have a whole chapter in the book about placebos.
Yeah.
And your expectation of how you will be feeling and of what this treatment will do for you can actually have a very large influence on the actual experience that you have. And this can be a good thing, right? Like I'm in some ways, I'm a little bit pro placebo effect. You know, if there's something you can do and you expect it to make you feel better and it does, like that's great. On the other hand, you know, you probably shouldn't be wasting a lot of time on it that you don't need to be spending, or a lot of money and things like this. So I do think that it's important that we're not misrepresenting placebos. On the other hand, you know, one of the things I came away with is that if there's something that you can do that makes you feel better, that's sort of enough. And it's okay to sort of, you know, capture this expectation that you can build for yourself that this is going to help. And in a way, this is why having some sort of ritualized recovery thing that you do can be really powerful, because it's sort of you telling your brain, your body, this is my time to recover. Okay, it's time to relax now. I'm going to feel better.
And that's almost sums it up perfectly, right? Because as you were saying, the I've seen so many where the products have a little tag in there, and I think one of the quotes from your book saying that there is a lot of misinformation out there, and it's generally funded by people with a vested interest. So when you see products with a little strap line and some of them say science this and science that, you sort of start to question, as you've found and as you've perfectly explained there, is the sample size is too small, and people who've been tested are expecting it to have a positive effect. So it's not a true measure. And often these things, as you've said in other chapters as well, it takes many years of research to bring the information together. With the beer thing though, I mean, does alcohol actually have a negative impact? I know for some people, you know, pure alcohol, you know, like the IPA type stuff, the strong stuff, does it nullify? Because I had read somewhere, again, I don't know if it's true or not, but you can correct me if it was true or not.
Here's where I came down on this, and this is based on my own experience, what we learned in our study, but also, you know, there's now some more stuff in the literature. And I think really what it comes down to, and this is the boring answer that no one wants, but basically, in moderation, alcohol is probably, I don't think that it's probably great for you. I don't know that it's the secret, like if you're not drinking beer that you should start drinking it to help your performance. I don't, like, don't do that. No one who's not drinking should start drinking for performance reasons. But I think that very moderate, you know, moderate drinking, and I'm talking, you know, one beer after your run or whatever, particularly if it's part of the social ritual where you're coming together with friends and relaxing. Alcohol can, I mean, it does sort of physically relax us too. It is a depressant like this. And so I think it can be helpful in that sense. Is it something that's going to, like, you know, super increase your performance? No. If you are, you know, only, you know, consuming it in moderation, is it going to wreck your performance? Probably not. I haven't seen any evidence. And in fact, I've looked at there have been other studies now. People definitely see recovery detriments and performance detriments when people are drinking at higher levels. But if you're drinking at moderate amounts, it's basically a wash. And I think that, you know, so often we look at certain things and we want them to be almighty and powerful, but a lot of these things just don't make a lot of difference one way or another. And so I am pro beer, but the reason I'm pro beer is just that I think there is something helpful for recovery to get together. It's not the beer itself. It's this sort of ritual that it is, in the same way that, you know, people who get up in the morning and drink coffee, you smell that coffee, you sort of, it's all these cues that you're giving your body. Like, now it's time for me to wake up and be awake. Whereas the beer is sort of this cue to yourself, and the alcohol and the taste and all of this is like, okay, now it's time for me to unwind. It's time to relax. And that's the real benefit.
Absolutely. The ritual thing, I think I see things in terms of when people get up, they have like a 5-point, you know, they've got a glass of water with lemon. They get up, they drink that glass of water, they get up, they do certain stretches. They then go to the kitchen, put the kettle on, and so on. It's that ritual thing. That's the waking up process. And people have a ritual in terms of going to sleep. And obviously, sleep is one of the best recoveries. But we talk about the sample sizes and the science, which sort of leads on to one of those chapters where a certain brand caught on to the fact that you don't actually need the science, which was the Be Like Mike, which I think in today's modern age, it's called influencers, celebrities, and whatever we want to call them. Can you quickly go through how, because it was Gatorade, was it not? That suddenly caught
on.
If they brought on a certain celebrity and got him holding it, drinking it, what was that all about? The Be Like Mike.
Well, I think, you know, we all want to be like our sports heroes. And at the time, Michael Jordan was really, I mean, he was the GOAT, right? The greatest of all times. Still argue, you know. And every kid wanted to grow up to be like that. And he had sort of a big personality and was very popular. And brands and companies know this. So if they can associate their product with someone that we all idolize, they can sort of become shiny by association. Now, you know, Michael Jordan did not become the player that he was because of Gatorade, in the same way that Tom Brady, who is an American football player, did not get to be where he was because of these pajamas that he's selling that are very expensive. But I can't tell you how many. But I can tell you, I investigated multiple products that he is endorsing for recovery. And in every case, you know, the manufacturers and the marketers said, well, look, he's the evidence right there. And I think, well, how is that evidence? He was good before your product existed. So they're really trying to ride the coat trails.
How did you get on with the infrared pajamas? Do they, because I've come across, I think it's made its way here to the UK, there is infrared products here now. Does that actually help with the recovery? Is it good?
Infrared is just a kind of heat, if you remember physics. There's nothing particularly special or magical about it. An infrared sauna is just a sauna that's probably going to feel a little bit less warm than a regular sauna. Heat can feel really nice. Is there anything that special about it? If a sauna makes you feel better, fine. There isn't actually really great evidence that saunas improve recovery much. They do increase when you're hot, your blood flow increases. So it can help with circulation a little bit. But here's the thing, athletes don't generally have problems with circulation. And you can also get the same with a little bit of a cool down where you're exercising at a very, you know, easy pace afterwards. And so, you know, it's sort of looking beyond what you really need. So again, this goes back to, there's nothing magical about infrared. But if you are using a product that has infrared, you know, an infrared sauna, for instance, and that helps you relax and feel good, then that's fine. But this is just an example of using scientific sounding terminology to make something seem sort of more powerful or bona fide than it really is.
I mean, there's things now. I think we could probably talk forever, Christy, but my sort of final question, which I've been holding back, but I've seen some products, services, whatever you want to call it, I won't name them just in case they might want to sue me, but They have a claim. They have quite, in my opinion, it's quite an outrageous claim, but is, can anything claim to stop an injury? Absolutely stop an injury.
That's my million dollar question, Chris. I mean, that is the million dollar question. That is the holy grail in sports research, right? I mean, everyone would love to do this. They're, you know, not just recreational athletes, but professional sports teams would love to have this. And I can tell you that at this moment, there is nothing that exists that can stop an injury or that is guaranteed to prevent an injury. Yeah. You know, there are things that potentially could, there are strategies and things that may potentially reduce risk. For instance, overtraining increases your chance of injury. Training when you're sick can also, training when you're under a lot of stress, we know that injury rates go up then. Yeah, yeah. But there's no special magical device or treatment or thing like this. Although there are companies obviously marketing them that can, prevent an injury or stop it once it's started. I would love that that were the case. And if anyone ever figures that out, we'll know it because we will all be using it and injuries will go the way of the dinosaurs.
Oh, man. I did see an advert only today, and it's a shoe company that says it's designed to help reduce injury and keep you on the run. I can't think of any shoe company would design a shoe not to reduce injury.
Right. Our shoe's going to put you on the couch instantly.
Well, Christy, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I'd love to have you on the show again, because I think we only just literally touched the book. As I was saying, Christy is the author of the book Good to Go: How to Eat, Sleep and Rest Like a Champion. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, Christy, and I very much look forward to
it. My pleasure too. I appreciate it. It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.